This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Brian Fernandez, and the morning run starts its rapid ascent. We're taking you all the way to 10 o'clock in the morning. It, of course, is the 13th of September, and we begin with one of the big story, of course, for us in Malaysia was the meeting between our Prime Minister and the President of the United States of America, Donald Trump, yesterday. It was our time yesterday in the evening, and we'll be bringing you a lot of analysis of that meeting this morning, because a lot of numbers there.
Yeah, so I'll be speaking to Dodge Dolan about it, and we're going to be talking about also, I'm going to ask him what the perception is really in the US. We think it's a big deal here. Is it a non-event? And how it would it potentially impact trade and also investment into Malaysia?
Okay. So also in the news yesterday, Kedah has a new sultan. His Royal Highness Tunku Saluddin Ibni Al-Mahroom Sultan Badli Shah was proclaimed the 29th Sultan of Kedah. He is the younger brother of the late Sultan Abdul Halim Muazzam Shah, who passed away the day before. The late Sultan, in fact, has, as I believe in one report I read, 14 children, 7 sons and 7 daughters. And it's very interesting, Brian, from a succession point of view, because the different states of the Federation that have royals have different rules of succession. Yeah. So it's not all a primogeniture. It's not all the eldest son, right? So you see perhaps a rotation system and such. And these are things that are set depending on the state and their history. Now, also, European countries are boosting their efforts in their respective Caribbean territories devastated by Hurricane Irma. Amid criticism that they didn't respond fast enough to avert or at least mitigate the disaster that came with the hurricane.
In fact, Sharad, I think there's and somebody that's close to the ground, Richard Branson, has actually called for a Marshall Plan for the Caribbean because of the scale of devastation.
Yes. Well, in Cuba, one of the many countries affected, at least 10 people were killed and 3/4 of the population are without power. Remember, we've been focused so much on the effects it was reported to have or potential to have on the United States mainland that we've, in fact, forgot to really focus on those Caribbean islands. Many of them are struggling themselves in development terms. And so now we're getting a fuller picture of those countries. So we're going to be, because there's all kinds of other news that we're going to be focusing on throughout the morning, and we'll be bringing that to you. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Brian Fernandez and myself, Sharad Kutan, and the morning run well on its way. It's coming up to 6:09. It is the 13th of September. If you want to join us in any part of this conversation, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio. That's BFM_radio. Or you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. And we'll kind of pull you into the conversation. We're very excited for anything you have to say. And that song, by the way, you just heard was No Fun by The Stooges. Because we are great fun on the morning run. And one of the reasons we're great fun is that we say so many things that are provocative that, in fact, we have a bunch of people trolling us. But trolls are an interesting phenomena, don't you think, Brian? What research has confirmed is that female writers often get more cruel feedback than men. Would you be surprised by that?
Well, I don't know. And that article is basically a US-centric article, and the writer of that article is actually female.
Yeah, the article that you're referring to is something we're going to be tweeting out, so you can get to read that as well.
But interesting, as I read into other related topics in terms of talking about trolling, there are different types of internet trolls, and there's the insult troll, the persistent debate troll, the grammar spell check troll, the forever offended troll. So really, I think categorizing the different aspects of trolling
Have you ever been trolled? Are you on social media enough and in a kind of public sort of way that you have your own trolls?
Well, I don't have a troll specific. But again, we work in media and we're on air. people give us feedback, whether negative or positive. And at BFM, we are told to treat all feedback, of course, very, very seriously.
Yeah, and we do. And, you know, I must say that personally, Brian, I have trolls. And I get people, some of them are not, I wouldn't say trolls. So trolls seems rather negative. I have people who are very interested to debate with me. So recently, I had somebody who insists on debating with me on the question of the existence of God. Because I say and I declare that I'm an atheist and I do not believe in the existence of this of God, this person who is religious and I believe is a Christian, was very interested to debate with me. And I was actually, I struggle to have that conversation because, these are people I don't know, right? So for me, the conversation had a curious quality.
Yeah, so, and that's one aspect in terms of religion. Say, for example, myself, I'm new to BFM, I'm new on air, so I face challenges every day in terms of feedback and dealing with feedback. So there are negative comments that come in that perhaps I should be as good as you are, Sharad. In terms of taking in criticism, I think it's important that you evaluate all of them and don't categorize them in any way.
I think the categories are quite interesting and are quite valuable. Look at those categories, and we're going to. This is, of course, as you say, it comes from an American-based
LiveWire.com. Yeah,
yeah, it's American-based website, I believe. So the insult troll. I think the insult troll is quite interesting because, and I see that dominating a lot of the internet, space for discussion. If you watched coverage of Hurricane Irma on YouTube, for instance, they had actually a live feed of comments, and it came fast and furious. Like it was like the pelting rain, like nonstop. And what happened was they were just, it was an insult after insult, and they used the word fake was there. You know, there was a fake newscaster, and this was fake rain. And I was thinking, what were people doing? I mean, were they just simply venting their frustrations by writing these things? And what a phenomenal waste of time.
No, and you're right about waste of time. And the thing that always strikes me is this. Where do these people find the time to do all of this? I mean, isn't there better things to do?
Well, it's positive. Yeah, so the positive things that trolls could do is, and this is the third in the category, the grammar and spell check troll. I love grammar and spell check trolls because I actually learn something from them. In the past, I'd be rather impatient and say, well, you know, this, after all, is Twitter. You don't have to. It's 140 characters. If you play around with a bit of syntax and grammar, it's okay, because you're trying to communicate rather than... But I always learn something. So for me, spell check and grammar trolls, I give them the thumbs up.
And what about the exaggeration troll? There's also an exaggeration troll where they... It's a combination of the know-it-all, the offended, or even the debate trolls.
Yeah, but that's again, if it's coming from somebody that actually does have information, and I do know that we're very trigger happy on social media, and I remember in recent times the article written by Bruce Gale that came out, and somebody said, who is this so and so, and he's probably just a hired hand to support the government, and then somebody chimed in and said, well, actually he wrote the biography of Musa Hitam, and he's been around since the 70s and is substantial in his observations of the country. So it was like people were so trigger happy, but then they have trolls who have deep background, and I love those trolls.
Yeah, and the trolls then do a fact check as well.
Okay. After these messages, David Bowie, Ashes to Ashes, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was David Bowie in Ashes to Ashes. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Brian Fernandez. One of the big issues, of course, it's a perennial bone of contention, is whether our education system is good enough and what kind of young people are we creating and how that, how that plugs into the aspirations we have as a nation, especially in terms of the economy, wanting, the creative industries to grow and such.
Yeah, so the Youth and Sports Minister, Khairi Jamaluddin, at the Pankow Dialogue 2017, said that society should see problems as opportunities and find innovative solutions to overcome them. He, however, was critical on how Malaysians use social media. And I quote him as saying, I don't have a recipe for what kind of societal mindset builds an innovative mind, but if we take social media as a yardstick on how we think as a society, then we are fast approaching towards the opposing end of an innovation society. He said that Malaysians basically are using social media as a platform to fight rather than to connect with others.
And the question, of course, is whether it can be just one or the other, right? I mean, there's always going, every platform for communication, when it's society-wide, whether it's a newspaper, television, have that potential, depending on how free they are. I mean, in the past, the government could rely on the passivity of these, controlling those platforms, controlling the newspapers, controlling television, because it was a one-way broadcast. Today, social media is a multi-directional broadcast with almost no capacity on the part of government, except for the sometimes, you know, the police action against individuals that's still so hard to police.
Yeah, that's why I find this quite troubling and surprising coming from a minister, because essentially, if you have open debate and a multi-platform discussion, you are more likely to crowdsource innovative ideas, thoughts, and so
forth.
But
is he criticizing that? In fact, it seems like all he's saying is that we've pushed to the end where it's become a kind of unhealthy thing. I mean, we talked about trolls just now. Yeah. You know, the trolling, the criticism, bringing people down, the attacks on women, all these, the moralizing that happens on social media that, in fact, stifles a difference and individuality. So he might be pointing to what is the real phenomenon, it's not just a Malaysian one, of people dragging each other down on social media rather than using it on balance for other more productive purposes.
Yes, but you can't use the sum of the negative aspects to then stifle debate and innovation. Now, if you, the worst ideas and the best ideas often come from open debates and brainstorming. So if you don't have open debates and brainstorming, and one of the key rules in brainstorming in terms of innovation is this: no idea is a bad one. If you've been on any sort of brainstorming session,
Brian, I can point to a few really bad ideas.
Yeah, but the thing is, during that process, when you are doing brainstorming,
Charlottesville.
For example,
I mean, let's go down the list. Marine Le Pen, bad idea. Bad person, actually.
Okay, but for example, if you're brainstorming new products and innovations and so forth, the first thing that you the first rule of engagement in a session is no idea is a bad one. We eliminate them later on, but in the initial brainstorming sessions, it was no ideas need to be discounted.
Okay, hashtag lemmings. next up, Red Hot Chili Peppers, My Friends, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Aretha Franklin with Good Times. What a soul woman, that one. My dying day, I mean, I'm sure she'll pass before me. Well, who knows, right?
Who knows?
But she is one of the greats, all-time greats.
How old is she now, Aretha?
I would say she's in her late 70s, but I guess we could check it out.
Probably
on
still rocking and rolling.
Yeah. Speaking of women, Singapore is going to get its first woman president, all-time first woman president. And it would have been an extraordinary moment, I think, for the women of Singapore and for the nation as a whole to finally recognize that women need to take this position at the helm of the country. Might be ceremonial. It's got a bit of executive power, but there you have it, Singapore. But it's come under a cloud.
Yeah, absolutely, because some Singaporeans have reacted with scorn over the process to select their new president. Now, Halimah Yacob was a former Speaker of the Parliament, was deemed the only eligible candidate by the Presidential Election Commission on Monday. Hence, she had no other opponents and she would be appointed unopposed. So critics would argue that, you know, if you want to rig something, that's about as easily that you can do in terms
of rigging it. Well, okay, before we start casting aspersions on Singapore and its institutions and whether it's rigged or not, I think it's important to kind of understand a bit of the history. Very quickly, it used to be a largely ceremonial role until the early 90s when they wanted to invest it with executive powers. And then there was some sort of constitutional tinkering that allowed for the election. So before the early 90s, you didn't have an elected president. So the first would be Yusof Ishak was the first president, so the first Malay president. And Halimah, of course, will be the second Malay president. We had Benjamin Shears and so on and so forth. And one of the roles of the president was to be on a minorities council. So the minority element was always there in the institution.
Yeah, and also very importantly, the whole idea said that the president would be the custodian for the reserves of the nation. Yeah, that so was that, another big issue.
That happened
issue.
Only in the early 90s.
Absolutely.
Right, with the electricity. Now, they kind of dialed back on it because they've had experiences, if you like. And Singapore tinkers with its constitution, you know, constantly. Because a lot of people will say they do so in order to rig the game, as you kind of alluded to just now, Brian, you know, that in some ways is a shifting goalpost. So to understand this, in this particular instance, Halimah Yacob came under one quarter, which is people from the public sector. They have a set of criteria they must fulfill to be able to stand for election. And then there was the private sector candidates with very different criteria.
Yeah, so there are two other Malay candidates who were deemed not qualified to contest. One is a marine services firm chairman, Farid Khan, and property firm chief executive, Saleh Marikan. So they both didn't qualify because neither had helmed a company with 500 million Singapore dollars in shareholder equity for the most recent 3 years. A key threshold for candidates who want to put their hand up for this role.
Yeah, so it's a completely artificial one. The idea that somebody running a company with at 300 million Sing dollars would somehow, if it's 300 million, would somehow not be qualified, but somebody who passes the $500 million mark would be. Now, what is it that in that 200 million would have changed in material terms about the quality of the person's personality, their commitment to the constitution, their ability to conduct themselves with dignity in that role? Is it about money? So there's one problem that Singaporeans have, which is that this elite have to explain why it is that they've chosen this artificial 500 million mark. After all, they tweaked it to make it that. Why couldn't they have brought it down in order to allow for these two individuals to contest? Because what's happened now is because she's had a walkover, people are now using the hashtag not my president.
Yeah, and so it's had a completely opposite approach in terms of or reaction to what the PAP wanted, which is basically to have a minority figure there that the Malay community in particular would be proud of. It's had a completely opposite reaction.
Right. So once they opened up this position to the electoral system, and then to somehow, kind of close it off, really has frustrated Singapore. And I understand Singaporeans, dominated by one party for their entire, life as a nation. They've only ever seen a PAP government in power. They now have a prime minister who is a son of a former prime minister. You have all that also in the mix. And then on top of that, the little space they have to make choices are taken away from them, or on this case, not, the rules don't allow for it. Let's put it that way. So without making allegations about any kind of conspiracy or such. And it's really unfortunate because the legitimacy of that position, now that the elections have been introduced, demand that people participate, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so much for that. After these ads, Led Zeppelin are going to California. And we'll be back with more. BFM 89.9. That was Going to California by Led Zeppelin. I'm Shoaib Khuttin, with me, Brian Fernandez. It's just past 50 minutes after 6 on the 13th of September. We're coming up to the news. And of course, the news has the last several weeks been full of rather dire stories coming out of Myanmar and the western state of Rakhine, where the Rohingya minority in particular has been targeted by security forces. Hundreds of thousands of people fleeing across borders. And also, the bigger neighbors of Myanmar weighing in, not on the side of the Rohingya, the oppressed minority, but on the side of Aung San Suu Kyi and her government.
Yeah, so Myanmar has denounced a suggestion by the UN human rights chief that its treatment of Rohingya Muslims amounts to ethnic cleansing. China said today it backs the Myanmar government's efforts to uphold peace and stability in Rakhine State. India's Prime Minister as well, Narendra Modi, said that India and Myanmar shared similar security interests on his first bilateral visit to Myanmar last week. So this is quite an interesting turn of events, Sharad.
And so the question, of course, is, you know, if you were a citizen of China, you're a citizen of India, and you were looking at this these gross violations of human rights, and what kind of a position would you want your government to take? China and India might be taking very geostrategic positions, one that emphasizes their national interests and, you know, the way it converges with Myanmar's, and pushing for a long-term strategic partnership, whereas and then might not be looking so much at the human rights aspect of it. I wonder, and because Malaysia has taken a fairly principled stand, though in many ways on the ground they're fairly inconsistent, a principled stand on the Rohingya question, can, you know, and do we want our countries to have an ethical foreign policy, or do we want one that, you know, primarily focuses on our national interests?
I think sometimes it's got to be a case-by-case basis. In this case, Malaysia has taken a principled stand. However, in doing so, it has broken ranks with traditional ASEAN method of dealing with individual countries' internal politics.
Yeah, but you, on the question of ethics, you cannot be a case by case. You can't say, we'll be ethical in this case, and then for my friends, we'll also be ethical, but for those neighbors, we won't be ethical. If you're committed to an ethical position, whether it's in foreign policy or in economics or whatever, then it's a universally applicable one.
But Sharad, you've got to be practical sometimes. Sometimes.
So this is where
China and India have come in. It's like geostrategic reasons overpower.
The question is, what do you want? As a Malaysian, do I want my country and our leaders to be, you know, convenient in their choice of who they ally with, and nimble and flexible and all that, as opposed to being, you know, tied down by some strong ethical positions? And I think this is a dilemma, because you can't pick and choose your ethical position.
No, on the contrary, Sharad. So let me give you an example.
You can pick and choose your ethical position.
You need to sometimes take the then strategic
it's not ethical.
Route. No, but you have to take the strategic route.
So then it's
sometimes.
Not ethical.
Well, let me give you a case, an example. So we take a position that basically perhaps angers one of our large trading partners, or one of the powers that be. So it's whether it's China or the US and so forth. And as a result of that, we suffer economically via sanctions or reduced investment. Do we want to suffer that fate? Sometimes we've got to take a strategic position.
Even though
it may not be...
But the choice, Brian, very simply is this. Conceptually, you can either be strategic, means you can change your position.
No, of course, yes.
And, or you take an ethical position, in which case the ethics of it have to be applied universally and consistently. So otherwise, it's not ethical.
No, then it's just opportunistic.
So
that's why I think I would veer on the side of being pragmatic foreign policy more than ethical foreign policy.
Ah, okay. So that's clear. So you're for opportunistic, strategic...
No, pragmatism.
Pragmatism.
It's not optimism.
It's not optimism?
No, it's not optimism. Opportunistic foreign policy. No.
Yeah. I think we have to remind the Malaysian leaders that there is not only a crisis in the Rohingya, among the Rohingya, or for the Rohingya rather, in the Rakhine State. There's, of course, that terrible humanitarian crisis out in Yemen, for which the Malaysian government seems to have taken no position. Next up, a two-door cinema club. Something good can work. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. It's coming up 6 minutes past seven, and it's the 13th of September. The morning run takes you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning. Remember, you can join us in our conversations at any point in time. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. That's BFM_radio. If you haven't joined us, do join us. There are over 210,000 people following us on Twitter. Also, you can message us on WhatsApp. That's 018-789-8899. There was an old number. This is the new number. So remember, it's 018-789-8899. Now, Brian, let's go to a study by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism at Oxford University. It found that 51% of Malaysian news consumers use WhatsApp to find, share and discuss news in any given week. The study was titled The Digital News Report 2017. We spoke to Dr. Julian Hopkins, a lecturer in communications over at Monash University. We asked him what could be the explanation what could explain this method of news consumption by Malaysians?
Well, I think that people have always shared news with friends and families. And it used to be you'd read something in a newspaper, you talk about it at the breakfast table, the coffee shop, at work, and so on. So people sharing news to their social circle is normal. But now it's easier to share more content to more people and over a larger geographical area. What struck me actually in the article is not only that WhatsApp is one of the places that Malaysia does the most of, but even in Malaysia, still more people seem to share news on Facebook than WhatsApp. And a big difference between Facebook and WhatsApp is that on Facebook, what you see is filtered by algorithm. Based on research that I've done, people tend to feel that WhatsApp is more private. And although not everybody is aware of all the algorithms and all the filtering that goes on Facebook, most people know that something is being filtered out. And so a lot of people feel more secure and more confident with WhatsApp. And that might also explain why they like to use WhatsApp in Malaysia, because it's something they feel won't go public.
And one of the concerns about the sharing and the use of the conversation that go on these social media platforms is that it is a form of a truncated communication, that we're in fact just consuming headlines. So, and we're not getting the context and the background of the story. So we asked Dr. Julian Hopkins more to kind of like give us more on the question of context and background.
That's an excellent point. I think there is that danger of the news becoming disembedded from the context of the news and disembedded from an institutional context. So a lot of people now may not, especially younger people, may not have a favorite newspaper or a favorite news source which they rely on. And so they rely basically on what comes through their Facebook, on their WhatsApp. And so they're sort of trusting their friends or their contacts to share something relevant with them. Previously, let's say you go back 50 years, somebody comes to work, they read something in the news, they're talking about it over the water cooler. There's likely to be an immediate discussion about that, some kind of discussion. People will see each other's reactions to the news. When you just put it on Facebook, you don't see how other people are reacting to it. Some people may react, some people may not. And although people do have conversations and comments on Facebook and other places about news, it's possibly just the people who are more motivated to comment on. People who are sort of less interested in news in general may not pay so much attention to it. And as you say, a lot of it's becoming truncated.
So we also asked him, finally, how this affects the way media organizations and journalists do their job.
I think news outlets and journalists are already very aware of this, and a lot of them are producing content that they hope will be shared. But what it means often then is that they are going to create content which is easily shared, so short news items, images, videos, sensational headlines, and so on, and more clickbait content. I think that's what happens. They're depending on people to reshare things. And once again, if you think about why do people share, so they have to work out what is going to make people share things. And they will emphasize that kind of content more. And that could be based on emotional or social status seeking or other things like that.
That was Julian Hopkins, a lecturer on communications at Monash University, speaking about a recent study done by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism at Oxford University, a study titled Digital News Report 2017, that found 51% of Malaysian news consumers use WhatsApp to find, share and discuss news in any given week. Are you one of those 51%, Brian?
Yes, I am, actually. And I think fundamentally what's happened is people consume news very, very differently now. I was speaking to an editor the other day of a car magazine, and he did an experiment and put out a car review, which traditionally would be, say, 1,200 pages. And he put out a version, 1,200 words of
that's
a car review.
That's two PhD theses.
So a 1,200-word version and a 300-word version. And guess what? The 300-word version was read 10 times more.
So no surprise, people have limited amount of time. They want you to get to the point faster. They just want to take that information, and they're mining it for the information. They're not interested necessarily in style and the way you communicate, how colourful your language is or how funny and entertaining you are necessarily, right?
That's right. And that's the whole disruption that's happening within the media industry itself. People are consuming differently. People want want to pay for different things. So the particular in the media business, of course, how news and is consumed is now moved away from print. And that's why globally there's a phenomena, and Malaysia is no exception. Print circulation has been falling off the cliff.
I'm a user of Twitter, and you know, there the impulse, in fact, that is encouraged is to share. It is to redistribute and to emphasize or even like something. And because it's 140 characters, I think very few people, myself included, when I retweet, I usually it's about keeping stock of all these different conversations. Maybe out of 10 stories that I tweet out or retweet, I would probably actually have read one, maybe two of those. Meaning, I click on onto the link and actually read the entire thing.
Okay, I've changed my behavior in terms of how I consume and share information because I actually shared a fake news article once and basically was bombarded for it. So now I'm actually quite careful in terms of how I share information. I tend to read the article, and if I think it seems legitimate, from a legitimate source, like say a Bloomberg or a Wall Street Journal, I would share it.
Yeah, I think one of the things is there's the issue of speed. Everybody wants to be fast. The system is fast. Everybody's fast. You become fast. And one of the big mistakes, and I've made this as well, this mistake in the past, which is I've forwarded a story thinking it's a current story when in fact the timeline is from 2 years ago or 3 years ago, or from a country that actually isn't Malaysia, thinking it was from Malaysia. And because I looked at the headlines and in the timeline, you know, the dateline's not actually stamped up front. And so, you know, you can make those mistakes. And I was very embarrassed by the mistake. You know, you try to apologize, but it, you know, the social media world is so unforgiving.
No, absolutely. And I did the same thing on Facebook once. And again, I got bombarded. So this is why the caution now in terms of self-censorship and quality control. I look at it, quality control as well. I mean, you've really got to make sure now that you're not sharing stuff, as you said, it's totally outdated.
The other thing, of course, is the role of the traditional media in slowing this down, giving depth, you know, giving context, broadening our horizons, all that. When the traditional media and the mainstream media, as we like to used to call it, still do to some extent, though I think a lot of websites are now mainstream, more mainstream than newspapers, is the question of credibility and the trust deficit that's built up around mainstream media, because for so long they thought their job was to aid government rather than be a critical voice in distinction to that. So all that very interesting stuff. We'll be back with more business news, political news, in fact, and analysis. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.